This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga, and here is what's coming up.
Angolan President João Lourenço announced Dos Santos' death on his verified Facebook page.
That was reporter Victoria Munga on the death of former Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos. Despite accusations of corruption and nepotism, many Angolans credit dos Santos with bringing stability to the country. All this and more coming up right here on Africa News Tonight. Former Angolan President José dos Santos has died at age 79 after prolonged illness. The country's current president announced the death in a statement today. Victoria Munga reports for VOA's, from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
José Eduardo dos Santos, who ruled Africa's second largest oil producer for nearly four decades, died Friday at Barcelona's Tecno Clinic following a prolonged illness. Angolan President João Lourenço announced dos Santos' death on his verified Facebook page. He described dos Santos as a statesman of great historical stature who led the country through very difficult times. Dos Santos, one of Africa's longest-serving leaders, stepped down in 2017 after ruling Angola for 38 years, a time marked by plunder of the nation's oil wealth and personal enrichment of his family members and political allies. Prior to stepping down to make way for his hand-picked successor, then-Defense Minister Lourenço, Dos Santos helped draft a law that granted him immunity from prosecution until 2022. He also appointed his children to head the country's $5 billion U.S. sovereign wealth fund and the state-owned oil company Sonangol. Despite accusations of corruption and nepotism, many Angolans credit Dos Santos with bringing stability to the country. His rule was marked by a brutal civil war lasting nearly three decades against the Union for the Total Independence of Angola, UNITA rebels. The war ended in 2002, and UNITA is now the second largest political party in Angola. In his statement, President Lourenco declared 5 days of national mourning in Angola beginning Saturday. The exact cause of Dos Santos's death has yet to be made public. He had been receiving medical care since 2019, and last month was moved to an intensive care unit at the hospital in Barcelona. Victoria Amunga, VOA Africa News Center, Nairobi, Kenya.
And now I'm joined by my colleague, João Santaria of VOA's Portuguese service. João, can you tell us what you know about President dos Santos' illness and death?
Well, we know very little about his illness. As your colleague said, it's been a prolonged illness. He went to Barcelona, to live in Barcelona, to get treatment. He came back to Angola in the beginning of the year. He stayed a few months and he went back to Barcelona, obviously very ill. He had lost a tremendous amount of weight. The immediate death, cause of death, was a cardiac respiratory failure. We have heard that he was on a wheelchair on top of the stairs in the house where he was, and that he fell down the stairs. And that's what caused the accident that caused his immediate death. But we don't know for sure.
I see. Can you talk about his origins in Angola and how he rose to power?
Yeah. Eduardo Santos joined the MPLA Liberation Movement when he was very young, 1961. He then, this was at the beginning of the Liberation War against the Portuguese. He went then to the former Soviet Union, where he got an engineer degree. He came back to stay with the MPLA in Congo-Brazzaville. He represented the MPLA in several African countries. Then at the time of independence, just before actually, 1974, he was appointed for the first time to the Central Committee. He was elected president when the first president, Agostinho Neto, died all of a sudden in 1979. I must say that his election was a surprise. Because he wasn't a prominent member, but I think it was a case of balance, of choosing a common candidate, let's say. So he came to power 79. On his side of... So that's how he came to power as a long-term member of the MPLA.
I see. Let's talk about his legacy in Angola. He led the country, as our listeners may know, for nearly 40 years. How do Angolans view him?
Well, there's two sides to President dos Santos. He was very important in negotiating actually two peace agreements with UNITA, one in 1992 that failed and the country went back to war, another in 2002. He also negotiated the end of the Cuban presence. Cuba had about 30,000 soldiers in Angola, and the withdrawal of South Africa from parts of Angola and Namibia, which led to Namibia's independence. So he brought a kind of stability to the country in that aspect. On the other hand, his government, you know, the MPLA was a Marxist-Leninist movement. And so with the collapse of the Soviet Union, it had to do a transition to, let's say, a capitalist movement. And the way he did this was through a patronage system, by giving jobs to the entourage and to his family. And so there was a tremendous amount of corruption. You know, his daughter, Isabel dos Santos, is the richest woman in Africa. And so I think that's the biggest, let's say, shade over his presidency is the enormous corruption and the stealing of thousands of millions of dollars that just disappeared.
I see. Well, thanks very much, Joao, and our prayers and everything goes to. Former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, one of Japan's most influential leaders, was fatally shot in the chest by what appeared to be a homemade gun during a campaign speech today. He was 67. News of the shooting rattled Japan, which has some of the world's strictest gun laws and sees very little gun violence. Abe had been speaking at a train station in Nara, just east of Osaka, when a man approached him from behind with what appeared to be a shotgun. Following two loud blasts, Abe fell on the ground. He was rushed to a hospital where he died. The alleged shooter was detained. Abe was Japan's longest-serving prime minister and an influential voice in the ruling Liberal Democratic Party. He stepped down in August 2020 but remained active in politics. Japan has provided extensive aid to Africa, and Abe visited the continent twice, once for a three-country tour in 2014, then to Nairobi for a Tokyo International Conference on African Development in 2016. Officials of South Sudan's Eastern Equatorial State say at least 60 people were killed and dozens of others wounded during cattle raids the past 2 days. A state official says security forces were dispatched to the area to contain the situation. State Information Minister Patrick Oting told VOA's South Sudan in Focus that hundreds of armed young men suspected of having crossed from the neighboring Greater Pibor administrative area attacked villages in the Kopiet North County and stole about 15,000 head of cattle. As they fled, local youth followed and a major clash broke out. Oting says most of the dead are the assailants. Cattle raids, revenge killings, and child abduction have become a common occurrence in parts of Eastern Equatorial State, Jonglei State, and the Greater Pibor Administrative Area, despite many goodwill agreements signed by the communities involved in recent years. The World Health Organization says Ghana has reported two likely cases of the deadly Marburg virus. The WHO says the highly contagious hemorrhagic fever is in the same family as Ebola. It's transmitted through direct contact with bodily fluids of infected people and contaminated surfaces. WHO says a preliminary analysis of samples taken from two patients from Ghana's southern Ashanti region, both of whom died, tested positive for Marburg. The two patients had been taken to a local hospital with symptoms including diarrhea, fever, nausea, and vomiting. Preparation for a possible outbreak response are being set up swiftly as further investigations are underway. WHO said it's deploying experts to support health authorities in Ghana. Previous Marburg outbreaks and individual cases have appeared in Angola, Congo, Kenya, South Africa, and Uganda. And at least 13 people died late yesterday in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo when a rebel militia attacked a small town and burned a health facility. Officials in the town of Lume say fighters suspected of being with the Allied Democratic Forces carried out the attack. Some reports say as many as 20 died, including patients trapped in the burning clinic. And in the area of Rushuru, also in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, the M23 rebels carried out new attacks on DRC troop positions yesterday. The attacks came despite this week's call for a ceasefire by the leaders of Rwanda and DRC. The M23 and ADF are among the largest of the more than 100 militia groups fighting in the eastern DRC. You are listening to African News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all our favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Burkina Faso leader Paul Henri Damiba's planned reconciliation summit of former presidents got off to a rocky start today. Reuters reported that two of the five former presidents invited by Damiba, Isaac Zida and Michel Dafando, declined to attend. Meanwhile, dozens of protesters were holding a sit-in outside the house of former leader Roch Kabore, the president who was overthrown by Damiba's junta in January. Former President Blaise Compaoré, who was ousted in an uprising in 2014 after 27 years in power, returned yesterday from exile in Ivory Coast to take part in the summit. But many Burkinabes have blasted Compaoré's return as a free man after he was sentenced in absentia earlier this year to life in prison for complicity in the 1987 murder of his predecessor, Thomas Sankara, during the coup that brought him to power. The summit was meant to project political unity in the face of spiraling violence by Islamic militants. And in Sudan, Sudanese coup leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhani has proposed that the military would no longer participate in talks facilitated by the UN, the African Union, and the regional IGAD bloc. He said he wants instead to make room for political and revolutionary forces and other national factions to form a civilian government. But Sudan's main civilian bloc rejected his proposal. Burhani said the formation of the executive government will be followed by the dissolution of the Sovereign Council that has been serving as a transitional government. Joseph Sigo, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained the reasons behind the proposal and the rejection to VOA's senior analyst, Mohamed Al-Shanawi.
First, I think this is a tactical move responding to pressure. There continue to be protests on the street. The country continues to face an acute economic crisis. Some $4.4 billion of international assistance has been withheld because of the military coup in October of 2021. I think the military continues to hear from international negotiators that there needs to be a civilian government in place before the international community is going to come back in and support the economy in Sudan. So the military, I think, is trying to seize the narrative here and put the onus on civilians to try and come up with a government and solve the country's problems. It's basically saying, okay, we'll step back and let the civilians solve this. Of course, then if the civilians are not able to do so, then it provides a further pretext for the military to say that, well, we need to manage things anyways. I think there's also a strategic factor involved here in the military's move. You know, the military all along has been vying for a formula whereby it remains the ultimate or supreme power in Sudan while stepping away from the day-to-day governance responsibilities and stepping away from the externally facing government presence, both domestically and internationally, basically taking itself out of the public view and therefore the pressure that comes with resolving the various challenges that Sudan faces. And Burhan talked about this in saying that they want to set up a Supreme Council of Armed Forces. And basically this is, you know, a sovereign entity that would oversee the government. So in many ways, I think what the military is trying to do is similar to the arrangements that it's had in place throughout the transition, where the military remains the ultimate arbiter and decision maker.
Sudan's main civilian bloc, the Forces for Freedom and Change, rejected the proposal to make way for a civilian rule as a tactical and transparent maneuver and said the crisis will end with the coup leaders resigning. Would that lead to a way out of the political crisis in Sudan?
I think for the civilians to take control, they do need the military to genuinely step down. And in fact, the civilians are the individuals and institutions with the technical skills, with the credibility domestically and internationally that can lead Sudan out of the crisis. And indeed, in the early days of the transition from 2019, the civilians did restore a lot of credibility with various stakeholders, and there was a considerable level of international support to try and help Sudan. So I think what the Forces for Freedom and Change are calling for is the vision for the way forward. But that isn't what the military is proposing, and that's why many civilians have responded to Burhan's statement with deep skepticism, and it reflects the enormous goodwill and trust that the military has squandered from the Sudanese public because the military has reneged on previous commitments to follow through on the democratic transition.
That was Joseph Sigo, Director of Research at African Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA's senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Next up, a look at how the U.S. Justice and State Departments team up to involve more women in counterterrorism efforts around the world. We talk with Laurie Freeman from State and Heather Roche from Justice to learn the benefits of gender diversity in operational effectiveness and the overall fight against terrorism in Africa, Asia, or the Middle East. The vital role of women in counterterrorism this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
On Sunday, more than 2 million people in the Republic of Congo will vote for representatives to the lower house of parliament. Rosie Piotz in the capital, Brazzaville, reports on the last days of election preparations.
There is excitement in the streets of Brazzaville in the final days of campaigning for the first round of the country's legislative elections. Antoine Bien-Aimé Obam, candidate of the ruling Congolese Labour Party, wants to meet the women of his electoral district in Djere. He says that this is already a guaranteed victory for him after listening to how the women encourage him. He says that his mission will now be to advocate for the population of Djere. Independent candidate Axel Wilfried Ndinga campaigned in Brazzaville this week. He shows the same assurance of victory. He says he is happy with how his campaign has gone and is confident for the future. Axel says he has achieved all his campaign's goals and promises change once elected. The Independent National Electoral Commission says about 2.8 million people registered to vote in Sunday's legislative election. Nearly 1.9 million voters are registered for local elections. President Denis Sassou Nguesso's Labour Party is expected to retain a majority in the legislature. Sassou Nguesso has led the country for almost 40 years. More than 1,300 with their alternates are competing for 151 seats in the legislative elections, and 1,627 others are competing in the local elections. The military and police voted on July 4 so they can provide security over the weekend as people head to the polls. For VOA News, I'm Rosie Piot in Brazzaville.
Hundreds of thousands of Muslim pilgrims from around the world offered prayers today on the sacred Mount Arafat in Saudi Arabia, marking the climax of the annual Hajj. The prayers on Mount Arafat are the highlight of the pilgrimage, one of the five pillars of Islam, which all Muslims are expected to fulfill at least once. This year, nearly 1 million faithful were in Mecca. While that is less than half the number in 2019, before the pandemic, it's a sharp jump from 60,000 who made the Hajj last year. Tomorrow, Muslims around the world celebrate Eid al-Adha, the Feast of the Sacrifice that marks the end of Hajj.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Kenya is holding presidential elections on August 9. What's at stake for the people of Kenya, an economic powerhouse in East Africa? What are the primary issues driving the electorate? Can Kenya avoid the violence which marked the 2007 ballot? To what extent is Kenya a bellwether for democracy on the continent? New York and Nairobi-based experts preview the Kenyan elections. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. State Department recently issued its annual International Religious Freedom Report. The report gives voice to countless individuals around the world who have been killed, beaten, threatened, harassed, or jailed for seeking to exercise their beliefs in accordance with the dictates of their conscience. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, Rashad Hussein, highlighted three key themes in the report.
First, too many governments use discriminatory laws and policies and abuse their own people. We have seen two genocides of religious minority communities in recent years, in China and in Burma.
Following its designation as a country of particular concern for the first time last year, Russia has doubled down on its violations of religious freedom, rather than reverse course, said Ambassador Hussein. Russian courts regularly reach new milestones for excessive prison sentences against individuals who exercise their religious freedom, and Russian authorities carry out hundreds of home raids against suspected extremists that frequently include violence. The second theme in the report is rising societal intolerance and hatred that are fueling violence and conflict around the world. Governments must not sit silent or stand idly by in the face of such oppression, declared Ambassador Hussein.
Anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim hatred, and xenophobia are on the rise in many countries. Democratic backsliding and the rise in nationalism and nativist rhetoric and policies have been used to justify violence towards members of ethnic or religious minority groups and historically marginalized peoples.
But on a positive note, the third theme cited in the report is that collaboration among civil society, governments, and multilateral partners has led to some progress and offers hope in addressing these complex challenges, said Ambassador Hussein. Independent and strong civil societies help governments to solve problems and better serve their people by shining a light on the issues that matter most, said Ambassador Hussein. Where civil society thrives, governments operate with more transparency and accountability, creating a tangible impact on the lives of everyday citizens. Our greatest hope, declared Ambassador Hussein, is that together we can unite our efforts to ensure respect for freedom of religion or belief for all people around the globe, and we continue to stand in solidarity with all people seeking to exercise their beliefs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday at 2105 UTC, join me, Steve Miller, as I put the latest developments into a global context with interviews and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voafrica.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.